And now it's my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, Steve.
Yeah.
From Fresno?
Yeah.
All right, let's give him a big hand.
My name's Steve, and I'm an alcoholic. And, I'm from Fresno. My home group is the Village Group. My sobriety date is December 24th, 1989. I was 21 years old when I got here. Other than that, I'm probably just going to say a bunch of the same stuff you've already heard over and over. You know, I really have no idea what I'm going to say, actually. You know, I can tell you that I was sounding really, really, really good in the shower this morning. And too bad you guys weren't there, because I had some real insights to share. But, you know, right now I'm just kind of, just drove down with my sponsor and a good friend of mine, and I guess I'm just going to tell you what happened, you know. I want to thank Bill for asking me to be the speaker this evening. And he did send me a couple of emails. You know, we were going back and forth with the scheduling and everything. And he sent, I think one email said to ask if I would emphasize the spiritual awakening as a result of working the 12 steps. I think that's the way it was phrased. And I can tell you that when I got here, a spiritual awakening was not what I was looking for. I can tell you that I was 21 years old. I was visiting my parents in Fresno. I was on Christmas vacation, and I was out doing what I normally did when I came to Fresno, which was spending time with my cousins. We all come from the same grandfather that was an alcoholic. He got sober late in life. He was sober when he died. He was sober when I was a real young kid. He went to the Alano Club in Fresno. And, you know, I remember my grandmother describing him. His name was Earl. And my grandmother describing him basically like this. You know, Earl had the idea that if one did a little good, two would do a lot of good. And it was like that with everything. And I like to think that I have that same characteristic, you know. My cousins definitely have that same characteristic. And so when I would come to Fresno, we'd all get together. And I got to town and immediately hooked up with them and did what I normally do. And we were out drinking, and then we were looking for more stuff so that we could keep drinking. And, you know, like most cases, towards the end of my drinking, I ended up doing a lot of things that I swore I would never do. I don't know if anybody else can relate to that. You know, I come from a family that I was raised well. You know, I don't have a legitimate reason to be an alcoholic. I don't have a legitimate reason for having a shitty attitude. It just comes naturally to me. I don't have a legitimate reason to go out and screw things up, you know. It all just comes naturally. And I, you know, and so towards the end of my drinking, I had a real tough time making peace with the fact that I knew better, you know. And it wasn't so much the drinking. I mean, I love drinking. I love what it does for me. I love the feeling that I love everything about it. I like looking at the bottles. I like walking into the bar. I like giving the bartender a nod. I used to put my put my money on the bar because I didn't want to talk to anybody, and I love that, keeping my money on the bar, and the bartender just takes the bills and gives me change, and I keep going until that stack's gone. And I love that, you know. I love big fancy bars with lots of action and mirrors and lights. I like the little dive bars that just have like a window in the door, you know, and they're just totally dark. I love everything about it. And it was that way the first time I drank. The first time I drank, I felt like I had discovered something that everybody else knew about, that it was this great secret, and that you'd been keeping it from me forever, and that this was it. This was like, I don't know what to say. You know, I mean, it did for me what nothing else did. And it was instant, you know. That was one of the great things about drinking, is it was an instant solution. It was an instant change that would happen. And, you know, in one way, you know, discovering drinking, that was my first spiritual experience, you know. So I would start out with the best of intentions. When I first started drinking, everything was just exciting. You know, there was and the drinking would lead to an adventure. And I would start drinking and I would have bright ideas. Right? And these bright ideas would take me places. And when I first started, it was fun. You know, I hear alcoholism described, I've heard it many times, described as starting out as being fun, then it's fun with problems, and then it's just problems. You know, and that's kind of my story. You know, and I'm sure I'm not going to tell you anything that you haven't already heard. You know, I was thinking that today. I mean, you guys have this, I'm not sure how long this meeting has been going on for. You know, years. I know it's been years this meeting has been here. You guys have a speaker every week, right? You have like, so that's like 50, at least 50 speakers a year. For how many years? It's been 10 years? I don't know, 500 speakers. And I'm thinking they all kind of say the same thing, right? That life was screwed up. I couldn't control my drinking. And Alcoholics Anonymous changed my life. And that's kind of my story, you know. I can tell you that the moment I started drinking, I have never been able to control it. I like to think I did. I like to think that I had some type of control over my drinking. But if I'm honest and I think back, and, you know, the first time I noticed that was when I did my first step. When I was asked to sit down and analyze the unmanageability of my life and my powerlessness over alcohol, right? And I wrote about it, you know. And that was the first time that realization clicked. That realization that I've never been able to control it. I have one drink and I don't stop until something else makes me stop. I've never had the bright idea that, oh, I'm feeling it, I should slow down. That is not me. I've never put it down and thought, you know, I'm at a good place, let's just keep it here. You know, it was, you know, if one does a little good, two is better, right? And that would just continue to go. And it was always something outside of me that stopped my drinking. It was either I passed out, it was either I got in trouble, it was either I ran out of money, you ran out of money, we ran out, you know, of options. It was always some kind of circumstance that stopped my drinking. And I can tell you that I knew that my behavior when I drank was getting out of control. I had that realization towards the end of my drinking. My behavior was out of control, but I didn't know how to fix it. You know, I read lots of books. I tried lots of different things. I would sneak into, I went to a Catholic university, so they had a chapel on campus, and I would sneak in there, and I would sit there and hope to catch whatever it was they had, you know, because I could not figure out how I was going to fix things. I knew I was screwed up, but I never connected the dots to it being my drinking. I never connected those, because the last thing I ever wanted to do was to give that up. That was the one thing that was seemed to be kind of working. I mean, because I would get drunk and the rest of life didn't matter, you know? You know, that idea of being in the moment, I hear lots of that now, you know. Spiritual awakening is all about being in the moment, being in the here and now, all that kind of stuff, right? Well, drinking got me there, you know. Drinking got me to not worrying about what was going on, not worrying about the guilt and remorse that I had begun to accumulate over time, not worrying about what people were saying about me or thinking about me, not worrying about managing all the lies that were going on in my life. Because I don't know about you, but I had lots of lies. I had lots of stories that I was spinning to different people, right, to try to manage the chaos of everything that was going on. I had these friends over here, and I couldn't let these friends find out about these friends, because if they did, everything would get screwed up. And then I had the story that I was telling my parents. I had the story that I was telling my roommates. I had the story I was telling my girlfriend. I had the story that I was telling my wannabe girlfriend. You know, I had the story, all these different stories that were going on, and trying to manage all that. The only thing that would stop that spinning of my head would be to get drunk, you know. Just like the book talks about, you know, my drinking, the one thing that was causing at the root of all my problems was the solution to my problems. And I couldn't get out of that. I didn't know what to do to get out. So it was Christmas Eve morning, and I showed up at my parents' house, and I'd been out with my cousins, and I'd done a bunch of stuff that I swore I would never do. And I had one of those mornings that I had quite frequently. One of those mornings where I'm remembering the bits and pieces of the night before, and it's just making me, cringe, right? I'm remembering these little things, these bits and pieces, and I'm thinking, did I do that? I didn't do that. Did I? No, I couldn't have done that, you know? I know better than that. And I had those lots of times. And the usual thing what I would do is I would take the vow, you know, I'm going to straighten my life up. I got to stop this. You know, maybe I should just, you know, and I would throw things away. Right? I'd have those that morning where I'm thinking, and I'd throw things away. The problem with me is by 3:00 in the afternoon, I'm thinking I overreacted. And so I'm going out to the dumpster and I'm pulling everything back. So this was one of those mornings I was having all of those thoughts. I had all this guilt. I had all this remorse. And I don't know what happened. You know, I had this idea. I walked into my parents' house. They were sitting at the kitchen table. There's a straight shot. When you come in my parents' front door, there's a straight shot to the kitchen table. I opened up the front door, I looked, I saw them sitting there, Christmas Eve morning, and neither one of them could look up from the table. My friend Richie says, yeah, you know, Steve's a candy ass. He got sober because his parents looked at him funny. But, you know, that's pretty much my story. I walked in and they couldn't look up at me. I had been experiencing that little by little for, I don't know how long, about a year, the last year of my drinking. Friends were avoiding me. I'd walk into a room, they would look up, we'd catch eyes, and then they'd go the other way. You know? I began noticing that look of disappointment in people's faces when they see me drunk again, right? And that would happen over and over. And I would shrug it off, right? Shrug it off, you know, just keep drinking. It's okay, you know. They just need to get off my back, you know. I need to lighten up. And, but all of those little things kind of, you know, they just piled up and piled up and piled up. And I just think that, you know, that last thing was noticing that my parents could no longer, it was too painful for them to look at me, right? Especially the morning after. And so my immediate reaction to that is, shit, they're pissed. I got to get out of this. And so part of it, you know, I think I tattled on myself because I wanted to get out of trouble. But, you know, I also had this, I knew that something had to change. I knew that the night before, I did not intend for all that stuff to happen that happened. I knew that. And I knew that my best intentions, I could not get a hold of my behavior when I drank. So I tattled on myself, you know. I've been doing lots of stuff on my own up to that point to try to shape up. You know, I would, you know, I mentioned going to church. I meant, you know, reading books, and I would give myself pep talks. I don't know if anybody else would give yourself pep talks, but I would, before going out, I would give myself this pep talk. You know, that I'm gonna, okay, you know, we're gonna drink, we're gonna have a good time, but not gonna get out of control. Once you get drunk, you're not going to open your mouth. You know, you're not going to turn into a mean drunk. You're not going to, you know, let that animal come out, that asshole come out and just, you know, piss people off, right? And I would give myself these pep, okay, we're going to go out, but we're going to keep it under control. We're just going to have a few. We're going to get to the happy place, and we're just going to keep that happy place. But I could never do it. You know, I just said that. I could never stick to that happy place. And so, you know, I was trying for so long to figure it out on my own. And I was trying so long to try to straighten up all in my head, right? All in my head. So when I look back on it, you know, tattling on myself to my parents that Christmas Eve morning was the first time that I was really kind of letting somebody else into the insanity, right? You know, there's a phrase that's been going through my head for the last year, year and a half. And that phrase is, alone it is too much for us. And I can tell you that at that moment, fessing up, tattling on myself, was one of the first times related to my drinking that alone it was too much for me. I couldn't think my way out of it. I couldn't get to a happy place all by myself, you know. So I ended up going to a rehab. I went, I was going to, you know, they wanted me to do the inpatient. I remember going, it's called the ARC. It was in Clovis at the time. And had this intake interview Christmas Eve morning. And lady comes out and she's all happy. You know, oh my God, this is going to be your best Christmas ever. And I'm just, and I want to hit her. You know, I just want to hit her. And I want to, you know, you don't know. You don't know what I've been doing. You don't know me. You know. And so they went through the whole thing, and you know the interview thing. Oh, how much have you been doing? What have you been doing? You know, and I don't know if I was truthful. I doubt it. You know, I really wasn't truthful to anybody at that point in my life. I mean, I would tell you just enough. I would tell you what I thought you needed to know, or what, you know, just enough so that I wouldn't get in trouble, or maybe I would tell you some things so that you would feel sorry for me. Because I was really good at that. If you were mad at me, I would find a way to get you to feel sorry for me, right? And I would milk your sympathy so that I could continue to do my crazy behavior, you know? So anyway, I ended up doing this outpatient deal. I forget how many weeks it was for. I don't know, I guess I was there for like 3 weeks because then I wanted to go back to school, and it was the last night that I was in the group. We met every night, you know, and it was the last night I was in the group, and the whole group sat me down and they said, you know, Steve, we don't think you should go back to school. We think you should stay right here. We think you should, you know, it's all the stuff you hear in AA, right? You need to make your sobriety a priority. If your sobriety is not your number one priority, everything else is going to fall apart. You need to put things in perspective. All that other stuff, you know, there's one big problem, and the big problem is that you're an alcoholic and you need to stay sober. That's the one big problem. Well, they told me all that stuff, and I'm sure they meant well, you know, but all I could hear was, you're not going to make it. Right? All I could hear was, you're a screw up. You know, you're not going to be able to do it. And good luck, God bless, but don't blame us. You know, it's your bright idea. And so I went back to school, and I like to think that resentment kept me sober out of spite for the first year of my sobriety. You know. I moved to Fresno when I had 2 years of sobriety. I found the Village Group, and the Village Group has been my home group ever since. We've had different locations, you know. We've moved a few times, and but the home group has always been the home group. And I can tell you, you know, that the things that they tell us when we're new, you know, they tell us what? Well, one thing that I remember hearing is, if you have a bright idea, do the opposite. Right? But the things that they told us, and the things I still hear, are that if I go to meetings, if I get a home group, if I get a sponsor, if I work the steps and pray, chances are things will work out. And so the home group for me has been a lot of things. It's been a place where I feel most comfortable. You know, it's been a place where there are people there that know me better than any place else in any of the other areas of my life, right? You know, I've had a relationship with a sponsor for over 23 years, right? 24 years. And, shit, I couldn't even keep a friendship for longer than a week, you know? And I've had a relationship with this guy for 24 years. The guy knows me better than anybody. And so I keep going back to that phrase, you know, alone it is too much for us. You know, I have gotten a lot of mileage. I've done all those suggestions that were given. I got a home group. I got a sponsor. I've worked through the steps a few times. I'm currently in the process of going back and working through the steps again. And I'm saying that with my sponsor in the room, so you know I'm not full of shit, right? I have gotten a lot of mileage out of that thing in Alcoholics Anonymous with one alcoholic talking to another. I've read the book. I haven't read all the stories, if I'm honest with you, right? I've read the first 164 pages a few times. I've gone to big book studies. I've read through the 12 and 12. I have reflection books and, you know, readings, and I do all of that. But the thing that's made the biggest difference for me is that one alcoholic talking to another. Where the guy opened up and made me feel comfortable so that I could open up. I have this great capacity to keep you at arm's length. So one thing drinking did for me, kept you. Okay. So the idea of opening up and letting somebody into my life and becoming part of that, you know, was kind of a big deal. But that one alcoholic talking to another. And so this, you know, the email I got, right, from Bill, emphasized the spiritual awakening as a result of working the steps with you. I can tell you that spiritual awakening for me begins with one alcoholic talking to another. Working the first three steps tells me I'm crazy. It tells me I'm insane. And so what good is it going to do if I sit there and think through all my problems and, you know, come up with, you know, I can't work the steps by myself. I tried it. Early sobriety, I tried working the steps by myself. I would read through them, I would intellectualize them, and I could see, oh, this is about self-esteem. So I'll just think my way into higher self-esteem, right? I would think my way through the steps. I was thinking my way through, intellectualizing my way through the steps. But I wasn't taking the action of actually working the steps with another person. And it was that one alcoholic talking to another, working the steps with another person, that made all the difference. That continues to make all the difference. You know? I found myself, you know, I've been sober for 26 years now. I have a real full life. It's a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a direct result of all the things that they told me when I was new. Going back to those things. Continuing to do those things. I've got a lot of blessings in my life. I do. But I still have the alcoholism. You know, the craving, or the, you know, the craving, the obsession with alcohol. Maybe I don't have it right now at this moment, but I still have that alcoholism. I'm a true believer that if I work on my alcoholism, everything else is going to take care of itself. Once I got sober, life happens. You know, there's events, there's blessings, there's tragedies, there's great things, there's difficult things. I mean, life is life. I can get real distracted with all of those little things. I can get real distracted with all the little problems, with all the little things that I can't control. Right? I was told a long time ago that if I stay in the steps, I will be able to stay sober and be happy about it. Clancy has this phrase that he throws around that I relate to. You know, it wasn't about stopping drinking, it was about staying stopped. Because I could stop drinking, I could swear it off, but the staying stopped. That's the difficult part, right? The staying stopped. And in order for me to stay stopped and to be comfortable staying stopped, I got to do all this stuff. At least I do. I found that one alcoholic talking to another, working the steps, having a home group, being accountable, has allowed me to be happy not drinking. And I think that's the big deal, right? is being okay with life and not drink. It's not to say that everything's a piece of cake. It hasn't been. It's not to say that I don't fantasize about it every once in a while. The thing I fantasize about is not having a fancy glass of wine with dinner. The thing I fantasize about is when I see the guy coming out of the liquor store with a little brown bag and a pint. That's the thing that I love that. I used to love keeping the pint. I just... Well, you know, I have to admit, that's still not social drinking. I mean, I really thought I was a social drinker, you know. I don't know. Kind of all over the place. Hitting bits and pieces of things, but... The reality for me that I came to at about 24 years of sobriety, a year and a half ago, the reality that I came to was that it doesn't matter what I have done in Alcoholics Anonymous. What matters is what I am currently doing. Okay. I had worked through the steps. I had formed great relationships, great friendships, blood brothers, connections with my home group, speaking at different places, sponsoring people, working with others. But for me, none of that stuff that I had done kept me from becoming insane again. From none of that protected me from my obsessiveness and my alcoholic mind. Because at 24 years of sobriety, I was wound as tight as you could, like a top, right? And no one was behaving, right? No one was doing what they're supposed to be doing. You know, I'm real amazed that there are other opinions other than mine. You know, that there are other ways of looking at things. It always amazes me. Right? So that tightness that had been accumulating finally came to a head. And what brought it to a head was one alcoholic talking to another. What brought it to a head was several days with my sponsor, getting back to the reality. Because, you know, Sandy Beach, great speaker, Sandy Beach, talks about there's a difference. When I am out of sorts, it's because there is a discrepancy between the story in my head and reality. When there's a discrepancy between those two, I get restless, irritable, and discontented. For me, I get wound like a top. And so the story that I had constructed at 24 years of sobriety had to be popped. Right? Or like my sponsor says, he had to give me an enema. Okay? Since that time, I've been nice and clean. Since that time, I've been working on I've started going back through the steps. I had to get back to step one. You know, currently, you know, the last conversation I had with my sponsor was around the 10th step, you know. And this idea of continuing to take a personal inventory, continuing to do what they suggest, being engaged in Alcoholics Anonymous right now. Not last year, but right now. What am I doing right now? And I can move beyond that 10th step and flirt with the 11th step. Work on my spiritual condition. Work on all of that. You know, work on my conscious contact with God. Prayer and meditation. All that great stuff. And it works. I'm a true believer. But unless I'm going back to that 10th step, the 11th step starts to get a little dull. The shine wears off. Okay. Best way I can wrap my head around it is like this. I years ago, I read a perfect description by somebody that knows a hell of a lot more about God and spirituality than I do. There was a guy named St. John of the Cross. And St. John of the Cross was this, I think it was 16th century mystic poet. He was a monk. And he did lots of writing, you know, and he wrote lots of poetry, and he did lots of writing about God and the spiritual connection between God and what it's like to seek God, what it's like to be a seeker, what it's like to work on that spiritual connection, what it's like when you lose that conscious contact, that feeling of aloneness, where you get that black spot that you can't get rid of. And what he said, what St. John of the Cross said, was that God, he equated God to the sun. That God's grace and love is radiating constantly. I'm sitting in my house. The light appears to be coming from the window. And he used the metaphor that the window was actually the human soul. Okay? And so when we're looking at the window, it looks like the light is coming through the window, coming from the window into the house. That's where it looks like the light is coming from. But in reality, that light is coming from someplace else. It's coming from the sun, the true source of the light. Right? Well, over time, the window gets dirty. That's the nature of it. That's just the nature of it. There's wind, there's dust, there's rain, there's mud, there's birds, whatever. They make the window dirty. And it gets dirty. And it's not able to radiate, to illuminate as truly as when the window's clean. I have always looked at the 10th step. Well, you know, the 4th step. Then the 5th step. And then the 10th step as a way of, for me, to clean my window. The 11th step for me works so much better if I am continuously cleaning the window. And the only way I know about that, how to do that, is what they've taught me here. I didn't come up with any of this stuff, you know. It's all been explained to me. You know, and what you people have taught me here in very simple terms that I could understand without getting too philosophical, like I just did, right? Without getting too philosophical, right? Take care of your alcoholism and everything else will fall into place. That has been my experience. If I focus on my alcoholism, it doesn't matter about straightening people up. Because my life will fall into place. I've got one big problem. And that big problem is that I'm an alcoholic. And if I can remember that and make that my number one priority, then life tends to work out. And I never knew that. I could never have imagined that when I got here. I just wanted to get out of a jam. I wanted people to get off my back. I wanted people to lighten up and leave me alone. And I wanted to quit doing the things that created so much guilt and turmoil in my life. I wanted to quiet the voices in my head. Right? And I have ended up getting so much more in return. I mean, I don't know how to repay it. I don't know what my life would be like if Alcoholics Anonymous did not exist. I really don't. I don't know where I'd be. You know, lost. If I was still alive, I'd be lost. Because you people said things to me in ways that I could hear. Things that other people have been trying to tell me for a long time. but I couldn't hear it. I listened to you because you talked about the same insanity that I was feeling. I couldn't control my drinking. I believed you. You looked happy. I believed you. And you talked in the same language that I felt. I could relate to you. I couldn't relate to a priest. I couldn't relate to my parents, but I related to you because your lives were a mess and now you were just happy and you seemed to have your stuff together. You know, it's an amazing thing. Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new, please give it a shot. What do you got to lose? What have you got to lose? Thank you.